Dr. Peter Ford is the director of the HIV clinic at Kingston General Hospital and has done several landmark studies on HIV in prisons, and his conclusions are damning of the Correctional Service of Canada. Dr. Ford has criticized Correctional Service of Canada for not properly treating drug-addicted prisoners who often share needles and contribute to the rapid spread of infectious diseases such as hepatitis C and HIV. In May 2003, Dr. Peter Ford stated that there should be a public inquiry and public debate in regards to the rapid spread of HIV, AIDS, and hepatitis C in prisons. An article appeared in the Whig Standard newspaper with his suggestion for an inquiry and debate. The general practitioner of Millhaven Penitentiary, Dr. John Stanley, replied by writing a letter which was published on May 19, 2003 in the Whig Standard newspaper. Dr. Stanley stated, in part, that, quote, prisoners come into the prisons already infected, unquote. Another letter was written by prisoner Peter Collins on May 22, 2003, and mailed to the Whig Standard newspaper in response to Dr. John Stanley's letter. Unfortunately, the newspaper did not publish it. In the following, we will hear prisoner Peter Collins, who is presently incarcerated in the Bath Penitentiary in Bath, Ontario, share with us his unpublished letter.
Okay, this is my response to a letter that Dr. Jonathan Stanley wrote regarding his feelings and position about Dr. Ford's conclusions regarding the level and manner of response Corrections Canada's health branches have played in the current HIV/AIDS and hepatitis C epidemics that are ravaging the prisoner population in Canadian prisons today. I felt I should respond and share a prisoner's perspective at the issue. I'm involved in a harm reduction program called Peer Education Counseling that operates in the institutions. As a prisoner, I've taken a six-month course which focused on HIV/AIDS and Hep C, as well as other peripheral health, first aid, and counseling-type things. The purpose of the PEC course was to get prisoners involved in spreading information about these highly communicable diseases, sharing it with other prisoners. The premise being that other prisoners may be more receptive to health information from a peer than a staff member. The theories sound that the problem is where the rubber hits the road. It has been my experience as a peer education counselor that prison administrators, guards, and unfortunately even the prison health care workers resist the harm reduction efforts. For example, needle exchange, safe tattooing, methadone, educational seminars, and the actual sharing of relevant health and harm reduction information is actually banned from being shared. Resistance from corrections workers stems from ignorance and fear on a number of levels. The administrators appear unable to fathom the depths of this crisis, as well as being ill-informed about the diseases. They feel they can make rules to stop the spread of HIV and AIDS and Hep C. They also fear that genuine, proactive steps to reduce the transmission of diseases will be seen by the public as supporting, condoning, or encouraging unauthorized or illegal activities like injection, drug use, tattooing, and sex. Prison guards and their unions resist the harm reduction techniques mainly due to a collective ignorance and fear of the diseases, coupled with the premise that if they support needle exchange or safe tattooing, this will have the effect of making their workplace a more dangerous environment. The idea being more needles, more tattoo equipment equals more infections from their perspective. They also appear to resist the changing roles that they would have to adopt if these currently illegal activities were to become monitored and legally available. Prison healthcare workers' concerns are a bit more difficult to nail down. It would appear that due to the correctional subculture, healthcare workers begin to view prisoners not as patients deserving of dignity and respect, as well as treatment, but as recurrent problems that are unwelcome in a difficult job. Somewhere in the correctional environment, medical sensitivities have been dulled. The bottom line is that harm reduction steps and techniques are not supported, and this simply cannot be due to collective medical ignorance. Perhaps it's a job security issue. I weigh into this discussion stating that Dr. Ford is a member of the Expert Committee on AIDS in Prisons and has been a godsend to infected prisoners, a demographic whose numbers is steadily rising. The Canadian prison system has repeatedly dragged its feet in regards to harm reduction where HIV, AIDS, and hepatitis C are concerned, and they continue to take an approach that exasperates this epidemic. In Dr. Stanley's editorial interview, he is quoted as saying, "To say that Hep C is the fault of inadequate health care is ridiculous, and we're not responsible for these diseases. It's the nature of the prison population." These quotes insinuate that Dr. Ford has said the CSC is responsible for Hep C in the prison system, which is simply not the case. Dr. Ford's position clearly indicates that CSC has not responded with an intelligent, dynamic approach to battling this epidemic, and that in this regard they are directly responsible for the burgeoning numbers of cases that are coming to light in the prison system. Dr. Ford's position is based upon extensive and focused research. For well over two decades, community stakeholders have canvassed the CSC to try and encourage a responsible and proactive response to a healthcare crisis in the prison system. The official response from the CSC was initially one of denial. These activities are illegal and therefore are not happening in the institutions. The oblivion achieved by sticking their heads in the sand only worked for so long, and it is community stakeholders and Dr. Ford's research work that has forced the government to begin making sounds like they are addressing the issue. However, while the CSC and Health Canada have produced some pretty slick and shiny propaganda about the reasonable and responsible role they are taking to deal with this epidemic, the CSC still has its head buried in the sand and is still stonewalling the community health advocacy groups and preventing real harm reduction steps from being taken in the prison system. No doubt the question of liability will be hammered out by lawyers at the inquiry that is inevitably coming down the line for the CSC on this issue. As with the Red Cross tainted blood scandal, it's plainly a question of what they knew and what they did about it. Clearly, healthcare workers in the prison system are overworked, understaffed, and dealing with a steadily declining state of health in the prisoner population. And Ottawa has made significant cutbacks in the CSC healthcare budget. This translates into poor working conditions, oversights, mismanagement, and frustration. In a lot of cases, prisoners' lives are coming unraveled, in crisis and in pain, and less likely to demonstrate proper etiquette when asking for assistance. And this, no doubt, wears down healthcare workers until they see needy patients as the problem. Unfortunately, this oftentimes means that the prisoner who is in most need of treatment is placed on a back burner as a direct result of his or her inability to demonstrate manners to a standard that might ingratiate them to the beleaguered healthcare staff. Dr. Stanley states, "A lot of them, prisoners, divert methadone for fun or profit, or because they're being muscled. There's a huge market for it," indicating that weaning prisoners off addictive drugs isn't as easy as prescribing them methadone or other painkillers. Then Dr. Stanley cites some examples of how prisoners manage to share methadone. 1, spitting the meth back out. 2, vomiting the meth back out. 3, tying a syringe to a condom and then to a tooth and swallowing the condom, which catches the meth and then pulls it back up to share it with the supposed muscling prisoner. The difficulties I have lending credibility to Dr. Stanley's condescending and diminutive assertions is that methadone in Ontario is rarely used in the prison system, and therefore the small amounts are not capable of filling this alleged huge market. We currently have a 1.5% of our prison population on methadone treatment in the penitentiary that I'm at. On top of that example, the CSC has an institutional cap of prisoners not being allowed on meth at one time. It should go without saying that weaning prisoners off addictive drugs is not easy. That is, after all, why we refer to it as an addiction. The reality is that CSC resists fully exploring the potential of this harm reduction technique because many officials feel that to provide the medical treatment of methadone is the same as supplying free drugs to prisoners. However, my information is that methadone is a dirty high, which is not coveted by addicts unless they are sincerely trying to quit their addiction. If the CSC were legitimately concerned about methadone treatment being diverted, they would obtain methadone in an injectable form and not in the anti-injectable form, which requires it be taken orally and provide the injection on site in the healthcare unit. On the topic of fun, I ask you to consider the doctor's presented methods of sharing methadone, vomiting and spitting it back up. Someone who would actually ingest vomit and saliva and whatever viruses are floating around to acquire the methadone high is very clearly to all, apparently except CSC healthcare workers, in dire need of help with their addiction. As for the story about a condom being used with a string to catch methadone when swallowed and pulled back up the throat to give to another prisoner, this is a manufactured story that lacks any credibility. If you doubt my assertion, try putting a condom down your throat with a string around it and swallow a couple of ounces of orange juice and see what you come up with. Obviously, the condom's base rim will fold up under the pressure of the throat, and if it did remain open, perhaps someone could explain how this person would have been able to breathe with their airway covered up. The methods and degrees of secreting methadone for sharing, be it for a muscle play or for sale or for fun, as Dr. Stanley refers to, insinuate that these instances and circumstances to be so regular as to undermine the work that CSC does do to fight addictions and thereby reduce the possible harm. 1. Currently, a very tiny percent of addicts in the prison system ever see methadone or any addiction treatment prescription. The number is so small as to make Dr. Stanley's assertions ridiculous. 2. The argument that prisoners do outrageous things to acquire drugs simply indicates that there needs to be a much more solid response to the addiction problem. That response needs to revolve around significant drug counter-treatment and in-depth counseling, education, and programs. 3. The poverty level pay scale that prisoners receive is what drives the black market in the Canadian prison system. And 4. The urinalysis program was introduced to reduce the drug use in prison populations. The problem is that since its introduction, the CSC only punish prisoners when they discover drug use, thereby making prisoners more inclined to be secretive. The other problem is that soft drugs, hash and pot, stay in your system for 30 days, whereas crack, heroin, cocaine are flushed out of the system much quicker. The results of this reality has been an increase in the use and subsequent addiction to harder drugs inside, as well as a higher rate of overdose deaths, all in the name of trying to stay hidden from the CSC's punishment for being a drug user. 5. The lion's share of CSC programming, treatment, and resources go to sex offender inmates, and this makes it appear that the CSC finds them to be more acceptable people in comparison to drug addicts. Generally speaking, sex offenders, aside from their offense, fit into the community better. They hold down jobs, have family support, are very quiet and malleable while in the prison system. The drug addict, on the other hand, is given to unpredictable and/or volatile behavior. They can be loud, disruptive, and require more intensive intervention. The nature of addiction is that they will slip or fall back into drug use at some point, which CSC does not recognize as an inevitable occurrence in the treatment of addiction, but counterproductively they treat it as a failure worthy of sanctions. Non-sex offender prisoners with addictions generally have roots in lower socioeconomic situations, few work skills and poor employment history, etc. It would appear that the CSC has made a deliberate choice to write off the addicts. It's true that prisoners generally come from a vulnerable segment of our society, and are more likely to be living with the results of a risky lifestyle. But this should not allow the CSC and its health workers to provide second-tier health care and second-tier preventative treatment. However Dr. Stanley feels about the CSC health care getting a bad rap is unfounded. The fact is, CSC health care has worked very hard to earn their bad rap, and they certainly deserve it.
Yes.
If you have comments and or criticisms in response to what prisoner Peter Collins has written, he would like to hear from you. You can write him at the following address. Peter Collins, 079-283-B, Bath Institution, Post Office Box 1500, Bath, Ontario, Postal Code K0H1G0.